Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and all major podcast providers. So if you can't catch the show live, you can download it or simply use our free podcast player, which is available on our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you'd like to connect with us, please post a question on our wall on Facebook or send me a tweet at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. Today's show is sponsored by MyMumble.com, one of the leading voice chat service providers with locations all over the world. MyMumble offers free 5-seat voice chat service for life, as well as higher capacity plans for any group that requires a secure environment for confidential communication. Listeners of The Organic View can receive 15% off on monthly recurring power servers by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. For more promotional offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. Also, don't forget to check out our contest section on our website for your chance to win one of our cool prizes. For more information, please visit www.theorganicview.com/contests. As we continue our special series called The Neonicotinoid View, which is the only show that focuses on the impact of neonicotinoids, my special guest co-host Tom Theobald and I have quite a show lined up. On today's show, oyster farmer Larry Warnberg will be our guest to provide more insight into the situation in the state of Washington. For those of you that have been keeping up with what's been going on, this will be quite interesting, especially after our show last week. But for those of you that are not familiar with what's going on, recently the oyster farmers were granted a permit to use the water-soluble toxic chemical, imidacloprid, which is a neonicotinoid, in Willapa Bay and Grays Harbor. So first I'd like to welcome to the show Mr. Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, June, and the weather report from Colorado is it's a beautiful spring day.
I think that's going to be an official part of the show now, the weather report from Colorado.
Right.
So thanks for that, Tom.
You're welcome.
And good afternoon, Mr. Larry Warnberg. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, June. I'm glad to be here.
Mr. Warnberg, can you share a little bit about yourself and also how you became an oyster farmer?
Now, I was raised in Washington State, but went to school in various places, California and Illinois and Oklahoma, and worked my way through graduate school in clinical psychology, and took my first professional job as a pediatric psychologist at a children's hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And we served a four-state region, providing various kinds of care for metabolic diseases and genetic disorders. And gradually, I got into working with children who had terminal diseases. And this was in the mid-70s when chemotherapy was still a pretty new treatment method. So a lot of the children didn't make it. And it was a tough job. And after 4 years of that, I decided I wanted to do some more meaningful labor, and I built houses for about 7 years. And gradually, I migrated back to Washington State, where I grew up, and got involved in oyster farming. I found it was a good way to get my foot in the door on a range of environmental issues, especially water quality.
Can you explain to our listeners just how tightly knit is this community?
It's not as tightly knit as it used to be, but there's still large corporate farms that are passed down from generation to generation. Some of them have been swallowed up by a large international corporation. But it's still a pretty closed group. I was excluded from the Oyster Growers Association because of my attempts to demonstrate ways of growing oysters without pesticides. It wasn't appreciated, and they wouldn't let me into their club.
Could you also talk about the farming of oysters? The oysters were in a situation where, because of this particular type of shrimp, they were suffocating, so they basically wanted to kill off this species. Now, from what I understand about benthic invertebrates, they're basically like the kidneys of the ocean. They absorb all the toxins, all the chemicals, all the nasty stuff that's in the ocean. And the problem is that there's nothing that necessarily cleans their systems out. Their flesh absorbs all this stuff, and for someone who consumes oysters, I would think that that's a very serious threat.
Well, it is a concern about food quality and toxicity in the food, but you're right. The shrimp are part of the benthic animals that live in the tide flats. They are native species. There are actually two varieties, mud shrimp and sand shrimp. They have similar habitats. They don't eat the same thing as oysters. They're detritus feeders. In fact, when grown around oysters, they eat oyster feces and help improve the water quality. The oysters that are raised are not native. They originally came from Japan, and they're now raised mostly in hatcheries and then planted out into the beds. The problem with the shrimp is they tunnel, a burrow, and make the ground soft and spongy so that oysters that are grown on the bottom will tend to sink and suffocate. So the shrimp are sprayed at low tide, usually in the summer, and then the burrows collapse and the crop of seed can be planted. And hopefully it will mature within 2 to 3 years enough that it can be harvested before the shrimp repopulate and cause the oysters to suffocate. It's kind of a complicated story, but related to the shrimp overpopulation is the practice of harvesting oysters by dredging, dragging a big basket along the bottom at high tide behind a boat. And that tears out any vegetation and removes any shell that might inhibit the shrimp. So when oysters are harvested by these dredge baskets, what's left behind is soft substrate that's perfectly suited for the shrimp to repopulate. So then the spraying has to happen, usually on about a 5-year cycle. So I got into the business in 1983 looking for ways to grow oysters without killing the shrimp. And I was successful at that. I did it for 25 years. I just retired not too long ago. And many of the growers are using other off-bottom culture methods, and there's a range. There are half a dozen ways to grow oysters without killing shrimp.
Mr. Warrenberg, can you talk about the application process? How are they going to administer the imidacloprid in these two particular areas?
Well, there are two formulations that have been registered by EPA for this use, and they're both made by the same company in New Zealand called Nufarm, N-U-F-A-R-M. Now, originally Bayer Crop Science developed the neonicotinoids, but their patent expired, and so there are quite a few smaller manufacturers now, and Nufarm was the company that was willing to release their product for marine use by the shellfish growers. So with that little background, there's these two formulations. One is for ground application with a guy in a backpack sprayer, and the other is a granular. Well, the backpack sprayers use a powder that they mix with water. And then there's the helicopter or aerial application, which is a granule that they broadcast. I think that's how it works. Most of the spraying is expected to be aerial because they can cover a lot of ground. They have a limit of 1,500 acres in our bay and then 500 acres in the smaller estuary just north of Willapa Bay. That's Grays Harbor. So there's a total of 2,000 acres that potentially could be sprayed this year. And most of it will be aerial through helicopters.
Isn't it accurate, though, that they change that acreage every year over the 5-year period? So it's actually 5 times that acreage that's going to be applied.
That potentially, yes. You're right, Tom. Under the old permit with Carbaryl, they were limited to 600 acres per year. So they've greatly increased the acreage, claiming that the risks are lower than with Carbaryl, so they extended the acreage a lot.
How does this affect other species? Because obviously in the ocean as well as on the land, different species are dependent upon one another for survival.
Well, sure.
How will this How will this impact, say, the orcas?
Well, it's hard to say. Nobody knows because they haven't really looked at it. And there are big gaps in the research. For this reason, when the permit was drafted and there was a public comment period, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which manages the Endangered Species Act, weighed in against issuing the permit, saying it was premature because not enough was known about its impacts on endangered species. Now, it's well known that this is a non-selective pesticide, kills invertebrates, and the bay is full of invertebrates, not just shrimp.
One of the things that we were told last week by Mr. Rich Dungis, who is with the Department of Ecology, was that according to the research that they were given, imidacloprid breaks down in sunlight. My question is, if this is applied either through an aerial application or through a granular application, there are pockets of water in the ocean where you don't have a lot of sunlight. I live by the ocean, and I can see that for myself. Although I haven't been to the Bay Area, these two particular Bay Areas in question, I'm just curious, how is that going to work, especially since imidacloprid that has been applied is not necessarily going to receive that sunlight that they keep talking about that will supposedly break it down. So then what? So then it remains in the sediment?
Yes, it'll remain in the sediment for quite a long time. And now the ecology plans to do monitoring, and they have set a standard that after 2 weeks, 2 weeks after the application of the pesticide, they want to see no effect on other invertebrates. And so that's the measure that they've decided is appropriate. Now, the growers don't like that. They wanted to extend that to 1 month. But ecology will check at 2 weeks and see if these organisms, benthic organisms, have returned to the pre-spray level. We'll see how that works.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this affects the other species that feed upon
right.
the benthic invertebrates as well as other species that feed upon them.
Yes.
Everything's pretty much connected in this whole food chain. So if the larger species are unable to feed upon the smaller species that feed upon the macro and microorganisms, that's going to really upset the whole food chain.
It could.
I would think.
Yes. And the shrimp, the burrowing shrimp, are a foundation species that's a food supply for many other critters, from fish to birds, crabs.
One of the things that we found with land-based applications is that there's a significant sublethal effect, and at the end of 2 weeks, there may be no effect. That effect may not express itself for weeks or months. I'm concerned that they're overlooking the real characteristics of these chemicals.
Yes, and our state Fish and Wildlife Department also opposed the issuing of this permit because they were concerned about long-term effects on migrating salmon. And there's some evidence that the ability of salmon to find their home stream for spawning is impaired by exposure to this pesticide. Well, in spite of that evidence and that opposition from several state and federal agencies, our Department of Ecology issued the permit anyway, when they were clearly asked to wait until the studies were done. Now, you may know that EPA issued a product registration for this use against shrimp. This is the first time neonicotinoids have been approved for any aquatic or marine use. So it's a potentially huge market for other pest species if this is allowed to go forward. But the product registration was made conditional on the growers doing some fate and persistence studies over the next 3 years. Now, the point is, those studies should have been done before granting this broad permit. It should have been done under an experimental use permit, which limits the amount of acreage and requires a much more intense monitoring.
The label for imidacloprid specifically prohibits application to water, and any water below the the mean high water mark. How have they gotten around that?
Well, the growers went to EPA and got a product registration that overrides that restriction on use in water. That's how they did it. And EPA gave them the registration, as I say, as a conditional use. So if they don't meet the conditions of the studies, and the studies don't show any significant risk, or do show risk, then they could lose the product registration.
One of the things that's touched upon in the permit is the determination of an action threshold, and you've raised some questions about that. Could you just discuss that a little bit, Larry?
Yeah, sure. That is an important issue because in the history of this shrimp pesticide control issue, the standard for determining if a bed needed to be sprayed was a guy would walk out there, one of the oyster growers, in fact, not a state employee. He would inspect the bed that a farmer submitted as needing shrimp control, and he'd walk around and throw a one-square-meter grid down kind of randomly and count the burrows on the surface. If there were 10 burrows or more, then that farmer's acreage qualified for treatment. The problem is that biologists have looked at the density of shrimp and dug up the ground in square meter plots and found there's practically no correlation between the number of burrows you see on the surface and the number of shrimp under the mud. And the reason is there are many other mud-dwelling critters, especially a type of worm called polychaetes, and they make similar burrow openings. So the threshold of 10 burrows per meter has little bearing on how many shrimp are there. They may be just killing worms. The oystermen, of course, don't care about that too much. Worms make the ground soft, just as shrimp do. So they just kill all the invertebrates. So this program is, you know, it's targeted at shrimp, but they actually want to kill everything that makes the ground soft because of the way they grow oysters.
Determination of the action threshold is made by the users, as I understand it, with no oversight by the Department of Ecology. Is that accurate, and how do you feel about that?
Well, that's a major shortcoming in this permit. Under the environmental impact study that was done in order to justify this pesticide permit, it was recommended that an integrated pest management plan be developed, and that happened way back in about 1999. And the growers stalled on that for years and finally submitted an IPM plan that uses this 10 burrows per meter threshold. But it has no bearing with how many shrimp are there, so their IPM plan is meaningless. There's no action threshold that relates to how many shrimp are there. Currently, the shrimp are in decline. In fact, for the last 10 years, the shrimp population has plummeted.
In your comment letter, you say that that there is evidence that the shrimp are actually beneficial. Could you explain that?
Oh, yes. They aerate the ground, but just as earthworms work in soil, the burrowing of the shrimp keeps the ground aerated. They eat detritus. They provide food for birds and fish. They're an integral part of an estuary, and there's a lot of concern among estuary scientists about the loss, the population crash of burrowing shrimp, because they are such an important species. Well, to spray them, just especially with a pesticide that's non-selective and drifts when the tide comes in. Of course, they spray at low water, but the tide comes in soon after, and then the pesticide drifts around off-site. That's well known. So there's no way to control this toxin.
Most of my concern has been with land applications, obviously, but I get the impression from reading the permit and some of the comment letters that what they're proposing is to treat the tidal mudflats the way they treat corn ground, because there's also a grass that they're not very happy with, and they want to use herbicides to eliminate that.
Yeah, they are using an herbicide to eliminate an eelgrass that holds Well, it's a complicated story. I won't drag that issue in, but it's a side and related issue.
So we're just going to sterilize the environment for the benefit of this non-native oyster.
Yep.
Is that accurate?
That's it. It's using industrial farm methods out in an estuary where there's a great biodiversity, and it's a monocropping system. Using mechanized harvest that stirs up a lot of sediment and destroys aquatic vegetation. So it's not just the spraying. There's a whole approach to farming oysters that should be questioned.
Mr. Warrenberg, could you share with our listeners what the economic situation is in that particular region? Is it a wealthy region? What is the climate there?
Well, in Washington State, there are 39 counties. Our county has a reputation for being having the highest level of unemployment. The oyster industry is pretty important. It does hire quite a few people. It's a big economic engine locally, along with timber, fishing, and seafood products. Although 90% of the workers are immigrant labor, many of whom I've become friends with. I know a lot of the Mexicans working in the canneries and out in the tide flats, and they're great people. But the people who run the farms, I think, are playing with fire by putting these pesticides out in the water.
Well, they're also endangering the lives of the workers.
Well, there's that. Now, the applicators have to be licensed. They go through, they have to get a test if they're land applicating. If they do aerial, they have to hire a commercial licensed helicopter applicator. It's not cheap.
It could begin as early as the 17th of May, is my understanding. Is that correct?
That's right. The permit was issued April 16th, and there's a 30-day period where an appeal can be registered with our State Pollution Control Hearings Board. It's a three-member board. The commissioners are appointed, or the board is appointed by our governor. And we'll see. We don't know yet if anyone will appeal. We're hoping that it will happen. The Washington State Bee Association is looking at it pretty closely. Also, the Xerxes Society, which is concerned about all invertebrates, they have an attorney, and they're looking at this too.
Well, Mr. Warrenberg, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today. It's very interesting to learn more, especially when it comes to what the oyster farmers are dealing with, especially when it comes to any type of chemical application.
Thank you for asking.
We'll be watching this very closely, obviously, and we may want to talk to you again.
Well, thanks, Tom. Nice to meet you.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. Please check out our contest section on our website, which is www.theorganicview.com/contest, where each month we give away all sorts of prizes to our listeners. Thanks for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer for the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.